unborn of a woman can be righteous. Look, he does not trust his holy ones, and the heavens are not clean in his eyes. What Eliphaz says is significant. Here are two scriptural statements that God's heavenly council members are corruptible. They are not perfect. That's not terribly profound on the surface. The only truly perfect being is God himself. God never actually said that Job was incorruptible and perfect, only that he was blameless at the time of the council meeting. God knows that Job could indeed fail, just like the divine beings in his council. Even the lesser Elohim cannot be completely trusted. Free Imagers. God knows that none of his imagers, divine or human, can be completely trusted. The reason is straightforward. Though imagers are like God, they aren't God. That's a truth we all know too well from our own struggles and experiences in a fallen world. Without genuine free will, imagers cannot truly represent God. We saw earlier that the image of God is not an attribute or ability. Rather, it is a status conferred by God on all humans, that of representing God. God created humankind to extend Eden over all the earth. That's what the commands of Genesis 1:27, collectively referred to by theologians as the dominion mandate, are about. Humanity was to multiply, steward the creation, and govern on God's behalf. The goal was to care for the earth and harness its gifts for the betterment of fellow human imagers, all the while enjoying the presence of God. How all that happens in our post-fall world varies from person to person. In our experience, humans have widely differing abilities. Some never see birth due to natural death or abortion. Others manifest in their bodies the effects of a world that isn't Eden. Some human beings have severe mental and physical defects that impede or prevent representing God according to the original vision. And even if we're blessed with what we consider normal health, we're all subject to disease, injury, aging, and the weakness of a world subject to corruption. But imaging is bound to our humanity. Regardless of ability or stage, human life is sacred precisely because we are the creatures God put on earth to represent him. Humans who survive birth without suffering severe impairment, however, are able to represent God as originally intended. They do so by means of a spectrum of abilities we have as humans. These abilities are part of our being like God. They are attributes we share with God, such as intelligence and creativity. The attributes God shared with us are the means to imaging, not the image status itself. Imaging status and our attributes are related, but not identical concepts. One of these attributes is freedom. Free will that reveals itself in decision-making. If humanity had not been created with genuine freedom, representation of God would have been impossible. Humans would not mirror their Maker. They could not accurately image him. God is no robot. We are reflections of a free being, not a cosmic automaton. Put another way, God did not intend to create imagers that did nothing. True, even if an imager accomplished nothing, say an aborted human fetus, they would still be an imager. But God's original intent was to arm his imagers with both the will and the ability to carry out his decrees. Representation of God as his imagers and possession of free will are inextricably related. Since the lesser Elohim were also created as God's imagers, they too must have free will. Both human and non-human imagers are less than their Maker. Only God is perfect in the possession and exercise of his attributes. Every lesser being is imperfect. The only perfect being is God. This is why things could and did go wrong in Eden.
If that were true even in Eden, the place on earth where the council was present,
then being in the presence of God is no guarantee that free will beings will never stray or act out of self-will. Only God is perfect. Beings that are lesser than God, whether human or divine, are not perfect. The potential for error and disobedience is, by definition, possible. Trouble could happen in paradise, and, of course, it did. God's decision to create free imagers involved that risk. You might think that all the risk was ours. After all, the world of humanity has suffered in its wake. But the only way in which there was no risk involved for God is if you define risk as the threat of harm. God cannot be harmed, but he can be grieved. He is moved by human sin and suffering. God was willing to risk that to have humanity. What we've learned leaves us with important questions. Even though free will is necessitated by imaging and representation, is risk the right word to use of God's decision? If God foreknew all the things that would happen as a result of his decision, didn't he also predestine those things? But if he did so, how can we even talk about free will? How are Adam and Eve truly responsible? What about the notion that they would know good and evil, Genesis 3:5, and be like God? Does that mean God has an evil streak in him? These questions have long been debated. It may therefore surprise you when I say they all have straightforward answers. What we've seen in this and earlier chapters about Eden, God, and his divine counsel prepares us for the answers. God does not delight in evil and suffering, nor does he need it for his sovereign plan. The conundrums evaporate if we just allow the text to say what it says. We need to lay our theological systems aside, answer those questions like an ancient Israelite would have, and embrace the results. Chapter 9. Peril and Providence. We close the last chapter with a series of questions. How is it appropriate to talk about God's decisions involving risk? If God knew what was going to happen, and if he predestines the events, where's the risk? Perhaps Adam and Eve needed to be taught a lesson about good and evil. Surely God didn't learn anything. But how do we get God off the moral hook when it comes to the appearance of sin and evil? An ancient Israelite would have thought differently about these questions than most believers do today. One reason is that we have layers of tradition that filter the Bible in our thinking. It's time to peel those layers away. God's gift. We might wonder why God doesn't do away with evil and suffering on earth. The answer sounds paradoxical. He can't, because that would require elimination of all his imagers. But he will at the last day. For evil to be eliminated, earth and humanity as we know it would have to end. God has a chronology, a plan for this ultimate development. It could be no other way, given his decision to create time-bound humans as the vehicles for his rule. But in the meantime, we experience the positive wonders of life as well. Though God knew the risk of Eden, he deemed the existence of humankind preferable to our eternal absence. Despite the risk of evil, free will is a wonderful gift. God's decision was a loving one. Understanding that requires only a consideration of the two alternatives: one, not having life at all, and two, being a mindless robot, capable only of obeying commands and responding to programming. If our decisions were all coerced, how authentic would those decisions actually be? If love is coerced or programmed, is it really love? Is any such decision really a genuine decision at all? It isn't. For a decision to be real, it must be made against an alternative that could be chosen. We all know the difference between freedom and coercion. The IRS doesn't tell you that you may perhaps pay your taxes by April 15th. When you behave wrongly, where would the emotional healing of forgiveness be if the person you offended was merely programmed to say those words, or coerced to say them? Free will is a gift, despite the risk. Knowing good and evil. Several phrases in Genesis 3, 5, and 22 that have puzzled interpreters become more understandable in light of what we've been discussing. In Genesis 3, 5, the serpent, Hebrew Nahash, says to Eve, "For God, Elohim, knows that on the day you both eat from it, then your eyes will be opened, and you both shall be like gods, Elohim, knowing good and evil." This verse is like Psalm 82:1. The word Elohim occurs two times in the same verse. The first instance is singular because of grammar. The verbal knows is singular in form. While most English translations render the second instance as God, it should be plural because of the context supplied by Genesis 3:22. That verse reads,
"And Yahweh God said, Look, the man has become as one of us, to know good and evil."
The phrase "one of us" informs us that, as in Genesis 1:26, God is speaking to his council members, the Elohim. This tells us clearly that the second instance of Elohim in Genesis 3:5 should be plural. This fits well with Psalm 8:5, where the psalmist notes that humankind was created a little lower than Elohim. We aren't a little lower than God. We're light years lower. Relatively speaking, the gap is narrower if we assume the reference in the psalm is plural, a little lower than the Elohim. This is the way the writer of Hebrews takes the phrase. In Hebrews 2:7, the writer quotes Psalm 8:5 from the Septuagint. That translation reads the plural angels for Elohim, a clear plural. In Genesis 3:5, Eve is being told that if she violates God's command, she and Adam will become as Elohim, knowing good and evil. Notice that the phrase is knowing good and evil, not will be capable of good and evil. As free will beings, Adam and Eve were already capable of disobedience. Like God's holy ones in council, they were imperfect. But Adam and Eve had not yet experienced evil, either by their own commission or as bystanders. The knowing good and evil phrase with the same Hebrew vocabulary occurs elsewhere. Deuteronomy 1:39 says, "And your little children, who you thought shall become plunder, and your sons, who do not today know good or bad, shall themselves go there, and I will give it to them, and they shall take possession of it." The little children referred to here are the generation of Israelites that would arise after the original generation that had escaped from Egypt at the Exodus. That first generation had been sentenced by God to wander in the desert for 40 years until they died off for their refusal to enter the promised land in conquest. The new generation did not know good or evil and would be allowed entrance into the land. The meaning is clearly that the second generation was not held morally accountable for the sins of their parents. Though as children they were under the authority of their parents, they had no decision-making authority in the matter, and were thus not willing participants. Therefore, they were not considered liable. They were innocent. The same perspective makes sense in Genesis 3. Prior to knowing good and evil, Adam and Eve were innocent. They had never made a willing, conscious decision to disobey God. They had never seen an act of disobedience either. When they fell, that changed. They did indeed know good and evil, just as God and the rest of his heavenly council members, including the Nahash, serpent. Evil and foreknowledge. Acknowledging God's foreknowledge, and also the genuine free will of humankind, especially with respect to the fall, raises obvious questions. Was the fall predestined? If so, how was the disobedience of Adam and Eve free? How are they truly responsible? Since we aren't told much in Genesis about how human freedom works in relation to divine attributes like foreknowledge, predestination, and omniscience, we need to look elsewhere in Scripture for some clarification. Let's look at 1 Samuel 23:1-13. Note the underlining carefully. "Now they told David, 'Look, the Philistines are fighting in Keilah, and they are raiding the threshing floors.' So David inquired of Yahweh, saying, 'Shall I go and attack these Philistines?' And Yahweh said to David, 'Go and attack the Philistines, and save Keilah.' But David's men said to him, 'Look, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more if we go to Keilah, to the battle lines of the Philistines?' So David again inquired of Yahweh, and Yahweh answered him and said, 'Get up, go down to Keilah, for I am giving the Philistines into your hand.' So David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines. They drove off their livestock and dealt them a heavy blow. So David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. Now when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David at Keilah, he went down with an ephod in his hand. When it was told to Saul that David had gone to Keilah, Saul said, God has given him into my hand, because he has shut himself in by going into a city with two barred gates. Saul then summoned all of the army for the battle, to go down to Keilah, to lay a siege against David and his men. When David learned that Saul was plotting evil against him, he said to Abiathar the priest, Bring the ephod here. And David said, O Yahweh, God of Israel, your servant has clearly heard that Saul is seeking to come to Keilah to destroy the city because of me. Will the rulers of Keilah deliver me into his hand? Will Saul come down, as your servant has heard? O Yahweh, God of Israel, please tell your servant. And Yahweh said, He will come down. Then David said, Will the rulers of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul? And Yahweh said, They will deliver you. So David and his men got up, about 600 men, and went out from Keilah, and wandered wherever they could go. When it was told to Saul that David had escaped from Keilah, he stopped his pursuit. In this account, David appeals to the omniscient God to tell him about the future. In the first instance, David asks God whether he should go to the city of Keilah, and whether he'll successfully defeat the Philistines there. God answers in the affirmative in both cases. David goes to Keilah, and indeed defeats the Philistines. In the second section, David asks the Lord two questions. 1. Will his nemesis Saul come to Keilah and threaten the city on account of David's presence? And 2. Will the people of Keilah turn him over to Saul to avoid Saul's wrath? Again, God answers both questions affirmatively. He will come down, and they will deliver you. Neither of these events that God foresaw ever actually happened. Once David hears God's answers, he and his men leave the city. When Saul discovers this fact, he abandons his trip to Keilah. Saul never made it to the city. The men of Keilah never turned David over to Saul. Why is this significant? This passage clearly establishes that divine foreknowledge does not necessitate divine predestination. God foreknew what Saul would do and what the people of Keilah would do given a set of circumstances. In other words, God foreknew a possibility. But this foreknowledge did not mandate that the possibility was actually predestined to happen. The events never happened, so by definition they could not have been predestined. And yet the omniscient God did indeed foresee them. Predestination and foreknowledge are separable. The theological point can be put this way. That which never happens can be foreknown by God, but it is not predestined since it never happened. But what about things that do happen? They can obviously be foreknown, but were they predestined? Since we have seen above that foreknowledge in itself does not necessitate predestination, all that foreknowledge truly guarantees is that something is foreknown. If God foreknows some event that happens, then he may have predestined that event. But the fact that he foreknew an event does not require its predestination if it happens. The only guarantee is that God foreknew it correctly, whether it turns out to be an actual event or a merely possible event. The theological point can be put this way. Since foreknowledge doesn't require predestination, foreknown events that happen may or may not have been predestined. This set of ideas goes against the grain of several modern theological systems. Some of those systems presume that foreknowledge requires predestination, and so everything must be predestined, all the way from the fall to the Holocaust to what you'll choose off a dinner menu. Others dilute foreknowledge by proposing that God doesn't foreknow all possibilities since all possibilities cannot happen, or they posit other universes where all the possibilities happen. These ideas are unnecessary in light of 1 Samuel 23 and other passages that echo the same fundamental idea. Foreknowledge does not necessitate predestination. Things we discussed earlier in this book allow us to take the discussion further. God may foreknow an event and predestine that event, but such predestination does not necessarily include decisions that lead up to that event. In other words, God may know and predestine the end, that something is ultimately going to happen, without predestining the means to that end. We saw this precise relationship when we looked at decision-making in God's divine counsel. The passages in 1 Kings 22:13-23 and Daniel 4 informed us that God can decree something and then leave the means up to the decisions of other free will agents. The end is sovereignly ordained. The means to that end may or may not be. Implications. An ancient Israelite would have embraced this parsing of foreknowledge, predestination, sovereignty, and free will. He would not have been encumbered by a theological tradition. She would have understood that this is the way God himself has decided his rule over human affairs will work. These are Yahweh's decisions, and we accept them. This has significant implications for not only the fall, but the presence of evil in our world in general. God is not evil. There is no biblical reason to argue that God predestined the fall, though he foreknew it. There is no biblical reason to assert that God predestined all the evil events throughout human history simply because he foreknew them. There is also no biblical coherence to the idea that God factored all evil acts into his grand plan for the ages. This is a common but flawed, softer perspective, adopted to avoid the previous notion that God directly predestines evil events. It unknowingly implies that God's perfect plan needed to incorporate evil acts because we see them every day, and surely they can't just happen since God foreknows everything. Therefore, says this flawed perspective, they must just be part of how God decided best to direct history. God does not need the rape of a child to happen so that good may come. His foreknowledge didn't require the Holocaust as part of a plan that would give us the kingdom on earth. God does not need evil as a means to accomplish anything. God foreknew the fall. That foreknowledge did not propel the event. God also foreknew a solution to the fall that he himself would guarantee, a solution that entered his mind long before he laid the foundations of the earth. God was ready. The risk was awful. But he loved the notion of humanity too much to call the whole thing off. Evil does not flow from a first domino that God himself toppled. Rather, evil is the perversion of God's good gift of free will. It arises from the choices made by imperfect imagers, not from God's prompting or predestination. God does not need evil, but he has the power to take the evil that flows from free will decisions, human or otherwise, and use it to produce good and his glory through the obedience of his loyal imagers, who are his hands and feet on the ground now. All of this means that what we choose to do is an important part of how things will turn out. What we do matters. God has decreed the ends to which all things will come. As believers, we are prompted by his Spirit to be the good means to those decreed ends. But the Spirit is not the only influence. The experiences of our lives involve other imagers, both good and evil, including divine imagers we cannot see. The worldview of the biblical author was an animate one, where the members of the unseen world interact with humans. Loyal members of God's congregation, council, sent to minister to us, have embraced God's Edenic vision. We are brothers and sisters. Other divine beings would oppose God's plan. The original dissident takes center stage in the next chapter. Section summary. We are just at the beginning of our journey, but we've learned some key concepts already, concepts that will emerge elsewhere in the Bible to form patterns. Other ideas will accrue to these concepts, and the mosaic will start to take form. There are several takeaways from this first section of the book that will take on more shape and definition as we proceed. First, God has a divine family, a heavenly assembly or council of Elohim. These Elohim are not a replacement for the Trinity, nor do they add to it. Yahweh is among the Elohim, but he is superior to all other Elohim. He is their creator and sovereign master. He is unique. Since Jesus is Yahweh in the flesh, he too is distinct from and superior to all Elohim. While God has no need of a council, Scripture makes it clear that he uses one. His divine family is his divine administration. The Elohim serve him to carry out his decrees. God also has a human family and administration. Their status and function mirror the divine family administration. Just as with the members of the divine council who represent God in what they are tasked to do, so humans are God's imaging representatives. Just as God doesn't need a divine council, he doesn't need humans either. But he has chosen to use them to further his intentions for earth. Heaven and earth are separate but connected realms. God's households operate in tandem toward a mutual destiny. Their points of intersection along the way inform many other threads of biblical theology. With Eden, the divine had come to earth, and earth would be brought into conformity. Humans were created to enjoy everlasting access to God's presence, working side by side with God's loyal Elohim. But this yearning of God's came with risk, a risk that was fully known by him and accepted. Free will in the hearts and hands of imperfect beings, whether human or divine, means imagers can opt for their own authority in place of God's. Sadly, that will also become a pattern. Both of God's households will experience rebellion. The result will be the commencement of a long war against God's original intention. The good news is that there will be an equally committed effort on God's part to preserve what he began. Section Summary. We are just at the beginning of our journey, but we've learned some key concepts already, concepts that will emerge elsewhere in the Bible to form patterns. Other ideas will accrue to these concepts, and the mosaic will start to take form. There are several takeaways from this first section of the book that will take on more shape and definition as we proceed. First, God has a divine family, a heavenly assembly or council of Elohim. These Elohim are not a replacement for the Trinity, nor do they add to it. Yahweh is among the Elohim, but he is superior to all other Elohim. He is their creator and sovereign master. He is unique. Since Jesus is Yahweh in the flesh, he too is distinct from and superior to all Elohim. While God has no need of a council, Scripture makes it clear that he uses one. His divine family is his divine administration. The Elohim serve him to carry out his decrees. God also has a human family and administration. Their status and function mirror the divine family administration. Just as with the members of the divine council who represent God in what they are tasked to do, so humans are God's imaging representatives. Just as God doesn't need a divine council, he doesn't need humans either. But he has chosen to use them to further his intentions for earth. Heaven and earth are separate but connected realms. God's households operate in tandem toward a mutual destiny. Their points of intersection along the way inform many other threads of biblical theology. With Eden, the divine had come to earth, and earth would be brought into conformity. Humans were created to enjoy everlasting access to God's presence, working side by side with God's loyal Elohim. But this yearning of God's came with risk, a risk that was fully known by him and accepted. Free will in the hearts and hands of imperfect beings, whether human or divine, means imagers can opt for their own authority in place of God's. Sadly, that will also become a pattern. Both of God's households will experience rebellion. The result will be the commencement of a long war against God's original intention. The good news is that there will be an equally committed effort on God's part to preserve what he began. Part 3. Divine Transgressions. Chapter 10. Trouble in Paradise. The story of the fall of humanity in Genesis 3 seems straightforward, perhaps because we've heard it told so many times. The truth is that the passage presents a lot of interpretive questions. We've devoted some time to a couple of them in the previous chapter. Now it's time to examine the main character, the serpent. Once again, there's a lot more than meets the eye here. One of the things that always bothered me about the story was why Eve wasn't scared witless when the serpent spoke to her. There's no indication that she thought the incident unusual. I've run into some odd explanations for that, such as maybe animals back then could walk and talk. Well, that sort of speculation is aimed at preserving an over-literalized view of the text, and it's often accompanied by an appeal to science, a claim that snake anatomy shows snakes once had legs. It's a bit misguided when someone attempts to defend biblical literalism by appealing to the evolutionary history of snakes. And anyway, the whole approach misses the point. It also presumes that the villain was simply an animal. He wasn't. The truth is that an ancient reader would not have expected Eve to be frightened. Given the context, she was in Eden, the realm of Yahweh and his Elohim council. It would have been clear that she was conversing with a divine being. As we've seen in earlier chapters, the biblical author has telegraphed that Eve was on divine turf. Genesis 3 in context. In ancient Near Eastern literature of the Old Testament world, animal speech is not uncommon. The context for such speaking is that of magic, which, of course, is tied to the world of the gods, or direct divine intervention. No Egyptian, for example, would have presumed that the animals they experienced in their normal lives could talk. But when the gods, or magical forces, were in view, that was a different story. Animals were often the vehicle for manifesting a divine presence or power in a story. The kind of animal would often depend on characteristics associated with that animal, or on the status of that animal in the culture's religion. Consequently, the point of Genesis 3 is not to inform us about ancient zoology, or a time when animals could talk. We're not in the realm of science by design. Genesis telegraphed simple but profound ideas to Israelite readers. The world you experience was created by an all-powerful God. Human beings are his created representatives. Eden was his abode. He was accompanied by a supernatural host. One member of that divine entourage was not pleased by God's decisions to create humanity and give them dominion. All that leads to how humanity got into the mess it's in. In some respects, we know that the Genesis serpent wasn't really a member of the animal kingdom. We have other passages to help us grasp that point, particularly in the New Testament. We understand that, even though New Testament writers refer to the serpent back in Eden, they are really referring to a supernatural entity, not a mere member of the animal kingdom. This is how we need to think about the story of Genesis 3. An Israelite would have known that the episode described interference in the human drama by a divine being, a malcontent, from within Yahweh's council. Note: I refer to the divine council broadly here, as roughly equivalent to the heavenly host. In what follows, readers will discover I consider the divine rebel's description to be one of a divine throne guardian. The divine council need not necessarily be conceptually restricted to decision makers. Indeed, the analogy of human government in civilizations that had a conception of a divine council makes the point clear. Not all members of a king's government would be directly involved in decision-making, but they still worked for the high sovereign. End note. The vocabulary used by the writer reveals several things about the divine enemy that has emerged from the council. If we're thinking only in terms of a snake, we'll miss the messaging. My task in this chapter and the next is to help you think beyond the literalness of the serpent language. If it's true that the enemy in the garden was a supernatural being, then he wasn't a snake. But it's also true that the story is told as it is for a reason. As odd as it sounds, the vocabulary and the imagery are designed to alert readers to the presence of a divine being, not a literal snake. Making that case will involve comparing Genesis 3 to other Old Testament passages. But to see that those passages are indeed conceptually linked to Genesis 3, we need to review some of the things we've learned. Eden was the divine abode, and therefore the place that Yahweh held council meetings. Here are some of the terms and verses associated with Eden we briefly noted in the earlier chapter. I've added the Hebrew words behind the English. Chart of Hebrew terms, English meanings, concepts, and important verses. Elim and Elohim, the plural, has the English meaning gods, which contains the concept of council members, as illustrated in Genesis 3:5 and 22. Gan, which has the English meaning garden, which contains the concept divine abode, council meeting, place, as illustrated in Genesis 2:8-10 and 15-16, and Genesis 3:1-3, 8, 10, and 23-24. Ed, which means watery mist, Nahar, which means river, and Yamim, meaning seas, waters, which are descriptions of the well-watered garden of the council, as illustrated in Genesis 2:6, 10-14, and Ezekiel 28:2. Har, meaning mount or mountain, which possesses the concept of mountain range where divine council met, as illustrated in Ezekiel 28:13. Mushav Elohim, which means seat of the gods, place of governing authority, which contains the concept of the divine assembly, as illustrated in Ezekiel 28:2. End chart. You can quickly see that, other than Genesis 2 and 3, the other source of verse citations is Ezekiel 28. That's one of the chapters conceptually linked to Genesis 3. Its connection is explicit. Ezekiel 28:13-14 refers to Eden, the garden of God, God's holy mountain. The table does not list all the points of connection between the two. There are a number of others, most of them hotly debated by scholars. Note: the debate over the relationship of Ezekiel 28 and Genesis 3 quickly becomes very technical. This chapter and the next introduce a few selective points of connection and issues relevant to those connections. See the companion website for more detailed analysis of the grammatical, text-critical, and conceptual issues related to the Edenic reference in Ezekiel 28. End note. Back in the first chapter, I told you that there are many interpretations for strange passages in the Bible, but the best ones are those that make sense in the context of many others, the Mosaic. The relationship of Genesis 3 to Ezekiel 28 and other passages is going to illustrate that point. Ezekiel 28. Ezekiel 28 is not specifically about the fall of humankind. It's also not a commentary on Genesis 3. The chapter begins with God chastising the prince of Tyre. God accuses this prince of extraordinary arrogance. In verse 2, the prince considers himself a god, El, who sits in the seat of the gods, Moshav Elohim, a term associated with the divine council. The choice of El for who the prince considers himself to be is interesting. It also appears in verse 9, where it is in parallel to Elohim. The word El is another word that means God in Hebrew and other Semitic languages. The people of Ugarit called their high god El. They used the term as a proper name. So did the people of Tyre, which was a Phoenician city. The Phoenician religion had a divine council led by El, who was also called Elyon Most High, in Phoenician texts, and considered the creator of the earth. To the ancient reader familiar with El, the notion that the Prince of Tyre would think himself fit to rule in El's place, or even to be a more generic deity participant in the divine council, would be ludicrous. For biblical writers, the idea was also offensive. For them, Yahweh was Most High, the true King of all gods and creator of heaven and earth. This is why the biblical writers refer to Yahweh as El Elyon, God Most High, Genesis 14:20 and 22. The point of assigning El and Elyon to Yahweh was not to endorse how Phoenicians and residents of Ugarit thought about their gods, but to assert Yahweh's superiority. He was incomparable among spiritual beings, and others were pretenders. Consequently, the biblical writers would have viewed the human arrogance of the Prince of Tyre as an affront to the God of Israel. God proceeds to acknowledge the great intelligence of this prince, but reminds him that he is no God, and certainly not the Most High. This sort of arrogance must be punished. Judgment will come. God asks sarcastically, verse 9,
"Will you indeed still say, 'I am a God,' before the face of your killers?"
In verse 10, God adds a strange detail. "You will die the death of the uncircumcised by the hand of strangers." Since the Prince of Tyre is an uncircumcised Gentile anyway, the phrasing seems to lack coherence. If we read a little further in Ezekiel, the point would be clear to an ancient reader. The underworld realm of the dead, Sheol, is described by Ezekiel as the place where the uncircumcised warrior king enemies of Israel find themselves. This is the place of the Rephaim dead, quasi-supernatural beings we'll encounter later. It is at this point that God has the prophet raise a lament over the Prince of Tyre, the brilliant prince whose arrogance led to his fall, not only to the earth, but under the earth. God, through the prophet, begins, "You were a perfect model of an example, full of wisdom and perfect of beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God, and every precious stone was your adornment. Carnelian, topaz, and moonstone, turquoise, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, malachite, and emerald. And gold was the craftsmanship of your settings and your mountings in you. On the day when you were created, they were prepared." Ezekiel 28:12-13. These verses raise questions. The Prince of Tyre wasn't in Eden. He was in Tyre. We see now that although Ezekiel 28 is about the Prince of Tyre, in describing this prince's arrogance, downfall, and original state, the prophet utilizes an older tale of a downfall in Eden. The hubris of Adam? Many scholars argue that the Edenic figure in view is Adam. That perspective is workable with parts of the description, but not all of them. The more coherent alternative is the serpent. More pointedly, a divine being who has forgotten his place in the pecking order. But where do we see a serpent in Ezekiel 28? Let's look first at what's clear before addressing that question. This prince was in Eden, the garden of God. He is beautiful. Words like shining or radiant are what come to mind when reading about the panoply of gems that were his adornment. Some have taken this language to refer to a literal jewel-encrusted garment worn by the human prince. They, in turn, argue that the prince of Eden was Adam. They also note that many of the jewels listed here correspond to the jewels on the breastplate of the Israelite high priest. The picture, they say, is Adam as priest-king of Eden. Since Jesus was the second Adam and a priest-king, the analogy fits. The backdrop to the Prince of Tyre's arrogance is the rebellious Adam, not the serpent. This sounds reasonable until you start looking at how Adam is characterized in the verses that follow. "You were an anointed guardian cherub, and I placed you on God's holy mountain. You walked in the midst of stones of fire. You were blameless in all your ways from the day you were created until wickedness was found in you. In the abundance of your trading, they filled the midst of you with violence, and you sinned. And I cast you as a profane thing from the mountain of God, and I expelled you, the guardian cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was proud because of your beauty. You ruined your wisdom because of your splendor. I threw you on the ground before kings. I have exposed you for viewing. Ezekiel 28:14-17. Was Adam an anointed guardian cherub? Where do we read in Genesis 3 that Adam was filled with violence, or that his sin was propelled by the fact he was egotistically enamored of his own beauty and splendor? When was Adam cast to the ground to be exposed before kings? All of the phrases alluded to in the question above are important. Dealing with them will take the rest of this chapter and the next. The key question that frames any discussion of them is this. Is Ezekiel drawing on a tale about the rebellion of a divine being against God, or about Adam's rebellion against God? I believe the former is the more coherent, a decision that links what's going on here back to the only divine rebel in Genesis 3, the serpent. In what remains of this chapter, I'll begin to explain my reasoning and then continue that exploration in the next chapter. Another approach. Ezekiel 28:12b addresses the Prince of Tyre this way. You were a perfect model of an example. Some translations have, you were the signet of perfection. This line is one of the more troublesome in the book for translation. Some scholars go as far as to list it among the more problematic in the entire Old Testament. The Hebrew word behind perfect model or signet ring, chet, vav, tav, mem, is the crux of the problem. The word is not a noun, but a participle that literally means the sealer. A translation of signet ring takes the term to denote some object, but the term is addressed as a person, you. The fact that this sealer is described as being full of wisdom and perfect in beauty also makes it clear that an object is not in view, but some intelligent person or entity. The question, of course, is just how this entity should be identified. Ultimately, the answer to this question derives from the answer to the previous question of whether Ezekiel is drawing on a story about a divine rebel or a human one. That question is the focus of the next chapter. But there are certain observations that can be made here that will help frame that discussion. Let's reconsider the gemstones that describe the appearance of the sealer in Ezekiel 28:13. As I mentioned earlier, proponents of the view that Ezekiel is drawing on Adam's rebellion for his analogous portrayal of the Prince of Tyre want to argue that the gemstones point to a human priest-king. But the adornment can quite easily be telegraphing something else. Divinity. All of the gems have one thing in common. They shine or sparkle. Luminescence is a characteristic of divine beings or divine presence across the ancient Near Eastern world and the Old Testament. This description of the divine cherub in Eden is designed to convey divinity, a shining presence. There are more details. The anointed cherub ultimately gets cast out of Eden, out from the midst of the stones of fire. We already know from other data that Eden is the place of the council. The stones of fire is another clue in that direction. This phrase is associated in other Jewish texts with the supernatural, mountainous dwelling of God and the divine council. It may be objected here that Eden was the dwelling place of God, and so the stones of fire do not only point to the divine beings of Yahweh's council. That much is true. But there's more to the phrase than a dwelling place. Other scholars have also drawn attention to the ancient Near Eastern propensity to describe divine beings as stars. Job 38:7 refers to the sons of God as stars, and Isaiah 14:12-13 refers to a being fallen from heaven as the day star, son of dawn, who wanted to ascend above the stars of God in the divine realm. The stones of fire, therefore, do not only describe an abode, but also divine entities in the abode. The ground to which this haughty divine being is cast and where he is disgraced is also of interest. The Hebrew word translated ground is eretz. It is a common term for the earth under our feet, but it is also a word that is used to refer to the underworld, the realm of the dead, as in Jonah 2:6, where ancient warrior kings await their comrades in death. Adam, of course, was already on earth, so he couldn't be sentenced there, and he didn't wind up in the underworld. Yet this is the sort of language we would expect if the point was the expulsion of a heavenly being from the divine council. Lastly, some scholars have suggested that the problematic term sealer, Hebrew, chet, vav, tav, mem, might be a cryptic reference to the serpent figure of Genesis 3. If their suggestion is correct, the point of confusion becomes a clever signal that Adam is not in view. There is a rare phenomenon in ancient Semitic languages where the final letter mem is silent, the enclitic mem. If the mem is made silent in effect removed from, our confusing word, the word becomes chet vav tav, which means serpent in Phoenician and other Semitic languages. That noun, in its lemma form, is chet vav he. Though the case for this reading cannot be made conclusively, its message would be to read Ezekiel 28:11-19 in light of Genesis 3 and its serpent. Note. As the next chapter and the companion website discuss, my view of the relationship between Genesis 3, Ezekiel 28, and Isaiah 14 does not depend on this reconstruction. There are many points of intersection between the three chapters. Ultimately, the issue comes down to whether a backdrop of a divine rebellion or human rebellion has more comprehensive explanatory power for all the interconnections. My view is that the latter view, though the majority view in biblical scholarship, cannot account for certain connections and is therefore less coherent. End note. It produces a play on words that takes us directly back to the scene of the fall in Eden. Since we know that we are not dealing with a mere animal in Genesis 3, but rather a divine being that is cast as creaturely, the description that this figure in the garden was an anointed guardian cherub makes sense. A cherub was a divine throne guardian in the ancient Near Eastern worldview. Note. Alice Wood provides an excellent concise summary of the morphological, grammatical, and text-critical difficulties in Ezekiel 28:11-19 that become part of the effort to identify the figure, divine or human, lurking in the background of this passage. See the companion website for interaction with her work. Bernard F. Bato takes a similar perspective. He describes the Edenic rebel this way. The serpent was a semi-divine creature with wings and feet like the seraphs in Isaiah 6:2, whose function was to guard sacred persons and sacred objects such as the tree of divine wisdom. End note. Ancient Near Eastern art and engravings have many examples of such throne guardians as animals, including serpents. There is little coherence to viewing the guardian cherub in Ezekiel 28 as the human Adam. Let's summarize where this leaves us. Ezekiel 28 browbeats the prince of Tyre using an ancient tale of divine arrogance in Eden, where a member of Yahweh's council thought himself on par with the Most High. This divine throne guardian was expelled from Eden to the ground or underworld. These elements show up in another passage, Isaiah 14. Note. One of the significant weaknesses of identifying the Edenic rebel lurking in the background of Ezekiel 28 as Adam is the relationship between Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14. Scholars acknowledge that the two passages have clear, undeniable conceptual overlaps, yet they do not posit Adam in Isaiah 14. Instead, they posit a divine rebellion tale as the conceptual source of Isaiah's portrait of the king of Babylon, while positing Adam as the rebel behind Ezekiel 28. This divergence in approach to two passages that contain clear points of overlap is methodologically inconsistent. See the companion website for a discussion of how an ancient tale of divine rebellion accounts for all the elements in both passages. End note. We'll consider what Isaiah says next, and then take a fresh look at what went on in Eden. Chapter 11. Like the Most High. In the previous chapter, we saw that Ezekiel 28 presents us with the tragic portrait of the Prince of Tyre. The prophet uses the literary strategy of drawing on an ancient story of a divine being in Eden who thought himself heading the seat of the gods, Ezekiel 28:2, the divine council. This being was punished with expulsion from Eden to the underworld. The portrait of this being as a divine guardian cherub, using the imagery of brilliant shining gems and a serpent, has conceptual links to Genesis 3. These elements also show up in Isaiah 14. We'll consider that passage and then take another look at the serpent in Eden. Isaiah 14. In Isaiah 14:4, God tells the prophet to take up a taunt, Hebrew mashal, against the king of Babylon. A mashal is better described as a comparative parable. The question to keep in mind as we proceed is, to whom is the king of Babylon being compared? Note. The mashal of Isaiah 14 has several points of correlation with an Ugaritic divine council scene involving a lesser deity snubbing El. I noted at the end of the last chapter that it is inconsistent to see a human rebellion, Adam, as the backdrop for Ezekiel 28, but a divine rebellion behind Isaiah 14, when all scholars agree they are conceptually related. With such an abundance of possible correlations to a divine rebellion story as the backdrop of Isaiah 14, why look to Adam in Ezekiel 28, which is so closely related to Isaiah 14? The major recent work on this is Hugh R. Page, The Myth of Cosmic Rebellion, A Study of Its Reflexes in Ugaritic and Biblical Literature. My conclusions will differ at point from Page's. He prefers the Kerit epic, which involves a human king, as the backdrop to Ezekiel 28. As I show on the companion website, all the evidences he draws for this proposal can also be found in myths of a rebellion of a divine being. In short, divine rebellion motifs account for all the elements in both biblical passages, which have clear touch points to the Nahash of Genesis 3. But the same cannot be said for appeals to Adam, or the Kerit epic. See the companion website for more detailed discussion on this point. End note. The beginning of the parable sounds as unfavorable to the king of Babylon as Ezekiel's description of the prince of Tyre is to that ruler. The king of Babylon is called an oppressor who ruthlessly persecuted the nations. The world will finally be at rest when the oppressor is laid low. In anticipation of the joy of finally being rid of the king of Babylon, the prophet writes, Sheol below is getting excited over you, to meet you when you come. It arouses the dead spirits, Rephaim, for you, all of the leaders of the earth, Eretz. It raises all of the kings of the nations from their thrones. All of them will respond and say to you, You yourself also were made weak like us. You have become the same as us. Your pride is brought down to Sheol in the sound of your harps. Maggots are spread out beneath you like a bed, and your covering is worms. Isaiah 14:9-11. As in Ezekiel 28, the figure in Isaiah 14 who is the target of its diatribe goes to Sheol, the underworld. The Rephaim are there, here identified again as the dead warrior kings. You have become the same as us. The king of Babylon will be one of these living dead, just like the prince of Tyre. Recall that Ezekiel 28 shifted from the prince of Tyre to a divine figure in Eden. That shift informed us that the writer was using a story of cosmic divine rebellion to, by comparison, portray the arrogance of the earthly prince. After verse 11, Isaiah 14 shifts to a divine context with clear links to Ezekiel 28. Those connections, in turn, take us conceptually back to Genesis 3. Isaiah 14:12-15 reads, How you have fallen from heaven, morning star, son of dawn. You are cut down to the ground, conqueror of nations. And you yourself said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise up my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mountain of assembly, on the summit of Zaphon,